you, it's A Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. Featuring stimulating, in-depth interviews with special guests from all areas of the arts. And now, here's your host for It's A Question of Balance, Ruth Copeland.
Welcome to the show where we balance the intellectual with the creative, exploring whether we have more in common than divides us through thought-provoking conversations. For the topic hour, I go out and about and talk to people on the street about a wide variety of different subjects that affect us all, both locally and globally. And for this, the Arts Hour, I interview local, national and international guests from all areas of the arts. And the show combines a debate topic with an arts interview because I feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways that we engage with the world. If you'd like to find out more information about the show, you can go to the website. It's aquestionofbalance.com. There's podcasts there of all my past shows, topics and guests. We've had some wonderful guests and some very interesting discussions. So again, that's it'saquestionofbalance.com. It's very easy to choose the podcast that you're interested in and listen to it when you want to. And also, if you want to connect with me on social media, you can do that also: Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. So that's it'sAQuestionOfBalance.com. Well, this week, as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be interviewing best-selling writer Joe Baker. Born in Lancashire in Britain, Joe studied English literature at Oxford University, then went on to study writing at Queen's University, Belfast, eventually achieving a PhD on the work of the Anglo-Irish writer Elizabeth Bowen. Joe's first book, Off Comma, was published in 2002, and she's gone on to publish five other novels: The Undertow, The Telling, The Mermaid's Child, Longbourn, and her latest book, A Country Road, A Tree. Jo has also written for BBC Radio 4, and her short stories have been included in a number of anthologies. Jo's book Longbourn, a reimagining of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice from the servant's perspective, was hailed by critics as brilliant, absorbing, moving and ingenious. Longbourn is a national bestseller, a New York Times Book Review notable book, a Seattle Times best title, a Christian Science Monitor best fiction book, a Miami Herald favourite book and a Kirkus best book of the year. Longbourn is also in development as a feature film. Joe's considerable flair for historical detail and nuance, showcased so effectively in Longbourn, are evident again in her new book, A Country Road, A Tree, where she reimagines the Nobel Prize-winning Irish writer Samuel Beckett's involvement with the French resistance during World War II, and his struggle to find meaning in the seeming futility of life and value in the written word. In A Country Road, A Tree, the title of which references a stage direction from Beckett's play Waiting for Godot, Joe explores the military experiences that ultimately contributed to giving Beckett one of the most powerful voices in the 20th century. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Well, it's lovely talking to you over there in England. What's the weather doing over there right now?
It's kind of doing what it usually does. It's kind of grey and green and kind of lush, but very mild.
Well, it's not raining, so that's good.
No, briefly, it's not raining.
You've said you can't remember a time before you wrote. I'm wondering if you can remember the first piece of writing or any kind of art that consciously had an impact on you, where you became aware of the power of art to deeply affect us, as well as just entertain us.
Yes, I think I was very lucky in that I was exposed to some really wonderful books as a child. It wasn't, I think, a deliberate project by my parents or anything.
Right.
But they would just make sure that there were books available. And I think some of those early books, things like C.S. Lewis, being read C.S. Lewis and sort of tracing the narrative of that and finding it so powerful and so sort of stimulating intellectually, not just sort of creatively, but being made to think about big ideas. That would have probably been the first experience that I had of that, yeah.
And obviously, you've said you were always writing. What drew you to writing as your art form, do you think, rather than, say, you know, painting or drawing or dance or anything else? What was the allure of writing? Do you know, or was it just natural?
Well, I did a bit of all those things that you mentioned, actually. I don't know, I suppose just over time you're sort of encouraged to specialise as a child. And whilst I enjoyed all those other things, I was pretty clumsy as a dancer. I was forever getting my feet trodden on and such. And I love drawing, and I always have done that a bit, but much more as an amateur. And I suppose one gets sort of filtered through school and you get more specialised, and I studied literature in A level and then went off to university to do it, and I suppose I was just, you know, absorbing more and more in terms of language and the history of our literature, and that would have informed the way I went, I suppose.
Did you grow up in a creative environment, would you say?
Not anti-creative, but not, I mean, in later life my mum painted and stuff like that, but very much after she retired. Bookish, yes, but not specifically very creative, I think. My dad was a university lecturer, mum was a primary school teacher when we were young, and so that it was encouraged, but it wasn't that, you know, people made things with their hands. Dad was always fixing stuff. There was a sense that you could sort of interact with the world in a practical way, but not. Writing was never a career possibility when I was growing up. There was apparently a writer who lived in one of the villages near us, and that was considered an incredibly exotic and exciting thing. And we sort of
a rumor.
Sneak around trying to get a peek at her.
Oh, that's funny.
But it wasn't something we were surrounded by at all, no.
No. So you studied English literature at Oxford University, went off to do that. What drew you to choose that degree?
That's a very good question. Drew, I think, is a really interesting word, because I'm not sure I was much drawn as pushed.
Okay.
I mean, it was a wonderful degree in that you got exposed to everything from, you know, Beowulf to Virginia Woolf.
You get
this sort of expansive range. Well, not so much expansive range as a sort of, what's the word? A very sort of thorough grounding in English, very much English literature. And very much sort of stopping at the modernists and not progressing on to the sense of anyone who was, you know, still breathing.
Right.
So I think that sort of, in some ways, that sort of had an effect on what I thought literature was for quite a long time. But the reason I did that degree was mainly because, you know, I'd done well at school, and the schools are keen for kids to go off to Oxbridge because, you know, it's a sign of you've done well, you know. And so I was just sort of following the line of, you know, that was laid out for me at that point, I think.
Yeah. You've said that studying literature at Oxford knocked the creativity out of you for a while because, to quote you, literature seemed like a graveyard full of monuments to dead great men, and that writing no longer seemed like something you could do. And the arts and indeed academia have been dominated by men for centuries because of the historical suppression of women. How did it feel to have writing taken away from you by that sense of overwhelm?
It was a horrible time, you know, emotionally. It felt really devastating, the idea that this thing that had been so important to me growing up was just not something that I could really aspire to. You know, it's sort of the classic kind of like over sort of intensity of that age, you know, the teenager, and thinking, oh no, the sky is falling, I can't do this anymore, and I'll have to think of something else I can do. Because, you know, although writing was never a sort of career path, it was always just part of my life, it was part of who I was, it was just a sort of reflex, reaction to the world.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, that, you know, you were saying that Monuments Dead Men thing. I literally had this image in my head back then of I had this little nylon tent and I wanted to pitch it somewhere. But everywhere I looked, there were these great sort of stone monuments with these amazing novels and, you know, these grand Victorian novels. And I just thought, well, there's nowhere for me to pitch my little tent. I'm not sure I want to anyway.
Yes.
But it was a sort of sense of, like, that I had to put it to one side as a childish thing, you know, and move on and be grown up about it.
Right, yeah. And obviously it can be daunting, you know, anywhere in the arts to look at what people have done before you and think, can I ever aspire to that? But how much of it was about being a woman, do you think, and just feeling like this is such a male-dominated genre, you know? Was part of it just feeling, as a woman, it would be so much harder for you, or...?
I don't know if I ever really sort of pursued it in that direction. I don't think I thought because I'm female, then breaking through would be hard for me, because I never really thought that I could even aspire to breaking through,
right.
If you see what I mean. But we did study a very male canon, you know, very male list of great writers. Are these the kinds of writing to aspire to? And I remember actually a friend of mine was recently reminding me that as students she was told that she wrote like a woman and she should learn to write like a man.
Really? Oh, my goodness.
Yes. And there is no such thing, you know. If you actually do a textual analysis, women are no more, you know, dithery or unmuscular or anything like that than men are as writers.
No.
It's just a kind of way of pigeonholing, boxing people off, dismissing them.
Well, of course, you know, that's why people like George Eliot decided not to use their real name, or even you today, you know, like with J.K. Rowling, you know, just to try and take the gender out of it. It's it's still with us, unfortunately, but changing, I think.
Yeah.
gradually, yes.
Yeah.
Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to my special guest this week, best-selling author Jo Baker, and we're going to go to some messages now, but we'll be back with more conversation very shortly.
Like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Ocean's black, but steam of late. No white horses to play the game. About you in the rain. Did I or didn't I say it's forever? Well, I know I said it, baby, just go nowhere.
It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Did you know about the Santa Cruz Art League on Broadway in Santa Cruz? Founded in 1919, it's 96 years young and provides a wonderful gallery space for local and national artists. It's a great place to view art with 14 shows a year and also to gain support if you're an artist yourself. There are art classes and weekend workshops, many taught by open studio artists. If you become a member, you receive a newsletter, discounts on classes, gifts and exhibit entries, images of your art on the Art League website, and guaranteed participation in the annual members show. It's also a great place to meet artists. Visit the Santa Cruz Art League at 562 Broadway or the website at scal.org That's scal.org.
I'm Casey, and I'm the second-generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore, and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years.
You're listening to It's Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, best-selling British writer Joe Baker. And in the break there, we heard from Bookshop Santa Cruz, and I wanted to let you know that Joe is actually going to be appearing at Bookshop Santa Cruz on the 26th of May at 7 p.m. She's coming all the way from Britain, so hopefully you'll head along and see her talk and be able to meet her and get your book signed, a new one, A Country Road, A Tree, or maybe one of her past ones, Longbourn or The Undertow, The Telling the Mermaid's Child. So again, that's Bookshop Santa Cruz, 26th of May at 7 p.m. You can find out more information on their website, bookshopsantacruz.com. And if you would like to find out more about Jo or engage with her, you can find her on Facebook. If you put in Jo Baker Writer, then that's J-O and then Baker Writer, you'll come up with her Facebook page, and you could connect with her that way. So, Jo, before the break, we were talking about your slight disillusionment with writing. And in 1995, you moved to Belfast. What predicated that decision?
Well, I had studied Irish writing when I was doing my degree. I'd done a paper on Yeats, and it had gone well, and I'd been really fascinated by his poetry. And I wanted to pursue that a bit further, so I went off to do an MA at Queen's in Belfast. And so they have an amazing MA on Irish writing. And that's why I moved to Belfast at that time.
So how did you find your writing voice again?
Well, at the time I thought it was gone for good. I mean, looking back, it was only about 5 years that I didn't write for, but it seemed like an eternity, you know, it seemed like forever.
Yes.
When I was there, there was just a kind of, and there still is, a thriving literary community. It wasn't, I hadn't gone there seeking it out, but it was just, it was organic, it was present. And so there was a writers group that was run by a novelist. At the time it was Glenn Patterson, and then, you know, it would be a rolling thing. I didn't join that, I was too shy to join that, but it was around.
Aww.
The people were writing.
Yeah.
And then there was lots of local poets and playwrights and such, and you just, through the degree that I was doing, through the literary events I'd have in the evening, you just get to see how many people there were around who were writing professionally, were publishing, were just, you know, it became a living thing. And I thought, if writing's done by people like this, I'm not that dissimilar to them. They're not, you know, here they are alive and normal and, you know, in the pub. And it just seemed like it was possible for me again. And so that's really how it just sort of started back.
Yes. When did you decide, do you think, that you wanted to write professionally rather than just do it as a hobby? And what motivated you to want to try and get something published?
That's a very good question. I mean, I was just writing initially. And my then-boyfriend, who's now my husband, was... is a playwright, and he was very encouraging. He was saying, you have to send it out, you have to send it out, you have to send it out. And I suppose, really, I would have probably come to a sort of either a natural halt, or I would have started pursuing that myself eventually. But the reason that I sort of got the sort of the arm twisted up my back and, you know, sending out packages to agents was because he was already doing it professionally. So he felt like, you have to be professional about this. You have to, you know, stick your neck out and get on with it, really.
That's wonderful to have that kind of creative support and impetus.
I think it makes the world of difference. I think sometimes people have got that within themselves, that kind of drive. But if you don't have that, having someone that's got that drive on your behalf can make the world of difference, really.
Yes, yeah. Your first book, is it Offcomer or Offcomer? How would you pronounce
Off-comer.
It? Offcomer. Offcomer. Is described as a young woman's search for her place in the world against the backdrop of the troubles in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
What motivated you to write this story as your first book?
Well, it's really, I mean, it's about, it's very much the Belfast that I was living in at the time. And it was a fascinating time because it was just at the end of the Troubles, when this, insofar as, you know, things have been trickling on and flaring up and stuff. But it was around the time of the Good Friday Agreement, and the city was changing so fast. And it continues to change very fast as well. I was back there just this week, and, you know, the place has sort of morphed again and changed, even though lots of very familiar things are still there as well. And I just wanted to really write, although the central character is not me, I wanted to write about the world as I was living in it. I really struggled, in a way, finding my voice when I was living in Belfast, because although I was writing, I was surrounded by people who were of the place, who were Northern Irish, who were writing about that experience. And I felt I couldn't really engage with it properly because I was an outsider. And that's what Offcomer means. It's where I'm from in Lancashire, it's a word that means someone who's an outsider, someone who's come in, a blow-in into town, you know. And so I wanted to write, eventually, it's not so much I wanted to write it, but that I found a way of beginning to write, which was writing about being an outsider, rather than writing about stuff that I felt I didn't have a claim to, like the Northern Irish experience.
Right, yes.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah, yeah. I was just going to say, that makes sense. So, yes. You
know. Okay.
Yeah. It's often said that we each have one novel in us, the story of our own life. Did you ever consider you may only have one novel in you, or did you always feel like, oh, I'm going to just breeze on with more and more stories?
I felt when I was writing Offcomer that I was mining my experience really deeply, and I was getting, you know, it was really all my life was on the page, and you know, I'd used up, exhausted all my resources. But then when you stop, when you've finished, you find that you've actually sort of cleared more space. You've got more space to work in.
Oh, interesting.
And
yeah.
I think everything that follows afterwards is still sort of channeling a lot of experience, but you kind of just have more space to play in, I think.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. What makes you want to tell a story? Are there common criteria, or does each story have a unique pull that makes you want to tell it?
So far, they've tended to be stories that I'm not seeing told otherwise.
Interesting, yeah.
The Undertow is, for example, is a story of a working-class British family through the 20th century, and it's very much about sort of the particularly about war as well, and where war sort of tumbles into their lives and turns everything over, and, you know, that's what The Undertow really is of history. And part of the reason I wanted to write that was because of my own background, which is from that, you know, from working-class background, take it back a couple of generations, really. And a sense of privilege as to where I am now because of the social changes we've had in Britain. But that story wasn't something that I was seeing written about very much in British culture. We tend to write stories about, you know, the wealthy and war, you know, the officer class. We have things like Brideshead Revisited. Those are the stories we're much more familiar with. And I wanted to sort of get in and tell a story that was more about, you know, a less told version, really, and something that felt really meaningful to me individually. And in a way, Longbourn's the same, really. Mm. It's about finding my own place within a narrative that otherwise I don't really belong in.
Mm. Because in Longbourn, you're also looking at the lower classes rather than the sort of more privileged classes. Mm. Yes.
Mm. Well, my grandma was a servant, so for me, reading Austen, loving Austen, I've always known that I can't really imagine myself in Elizabeth Bennet's shoes, you know.
No,
I'd always much more likely have been cleaning them back then.
Yes, yeah. My grandmother was in service as well. Yeah, she's from Sunderland. Yeah. So,
oh really? I was listening to your accent actually, and trying to.
I mean, I'm not from Sunderland, but
there's a hint of northernness there.
She came down south. Yeah, my father was from Lincolnshire, so got a bit of that.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you peel things back a couple of generations, and the reality is, you're much more likely to come from that strata of society than you are the more sort of ball gowns and nice shoes kind of strata of society.
Exactly.
And yet the narratives we sort of tend to tell ourselves are more about the upper than the lower classes. And when the lower classes do come in, they're mostly there in order to serve the other story, as it were.
Well, it's that kind of fantasy. It's almost like the fairy tale, isn't it? Like being the star of the fairy tale. I mean, that I was going to say they were the 1%. It was probably even less than that then. You know,
it's probably was, wasn't it?
The 0.2% who had this idyllic life where everything was done for them. And we all sort of, you know, I suppose think, oh, that would be nice. But realistically,
and if you think about it, and when you say fairy tale, I mean, even Cinderella, her dad was a gentleman, you know. It's rarely the case for most of us, I'm afraid.
Yes, yeah, that's right. As I mentioned in the introduction, your new book, A Country Road, A Tree, reimagines the Nobel Prize-winning Irish writer Samuel Beckett's involvement with the French Resistance during World War II. Mm. Why write about Samuel Beckett? Why his story?
Mm. Well, that dates from the MA in Irish writing and from sort of ongoing sort of concern or question or niggle about his stuff ever since. I love his stuff. I'm fascinated by it. And then alongside that, there's this sense of how different his early work is to the late work, which won him the Nobel, effectively, that made him internationally famous, that is Beckettian, you know, that word we use, Beckettian. Mm. It doesn't really fit with his early work. And I sort of struggled with this when I was doing my MA. I didn't really get my head around it immediately. And my tutor said, well, you do know that he was stuck in France during the Second World War, that he had to go into hiding. And suddenly those characters in the later work, those sort of lost, broken, persecuted figures, they begin to feel a bit more, there's a bit more context, there's a kind of a new light to see them by. It's not like it's the only way to see them, but it's a kind of useful little insight. And I just wanted to trace the sort of the making of that vision. I don't think that the war isn't the only thing that's informing him, obviously, because he's an amazing scholar. He's an amazing polymath and a polyglot. He knew, you know, all these different languages going around inside his head. Mm. And all this sort of wealth of literature and influence and visual art that he absorbed.
Mm.
And yet this war is tumbling around him and affecting him every day in very practical ways. And it fascinated me. But there's also, like, very little that he wrote during that period. There's one novel. You know, it's not bad getting a novel written during a war, but compared with the letters and the sort of those kinds of texts that we'd otherwise have, there's not much sort of in which he reflects on it. So I was just, it just felt like a bit of a gap, and I was fascinated by the sense of space there.
Mm.
The biographical details are known, but it's, you know, I felt that just sort of living in the moment and reflecting on the moment as it happened was something that was really fascinating.
Yeah. The book focuses on the years 1939 to 1946 in Beckett's life.
Mm.
Why did you choose to write the novel only about this period, apart from the brief introductory chapter, rather than his whole life?
Because it's such a transformational period.
Mm.
What happens after that is he stops and he literally locks. It's referred to as the siege in the room, in scholarship, and he locks himself away and he just writes. There's this massive surge of creativity over a period of time, and those works are those that sort of then he continues on afterwards, actually, obviously as well. But that's when he becomes the writer that he was going to be.
Right.
And what I really wanted to do was sort of trace the making of a writer and the making of the man as well. Mm. Because he makes a series of extraordinary moral decisions. This is another thing that fascinates me about him. Mm. There's these really big, difficult things he's faced with. Like, he's in Ireland when France is invaded. When war is declared, rather, and he decides to go back to France, where he's been living, to go back to Paris, rather than sit it out in neutral Ireland, which he could have done. Mm. He decides to go back and face the war with his friends and his partner. And then when his friends start to be persecuted by the Nazis and be rounded up and deported, he decides that he will give his rations to help others, you know. Mm. But at a time when there's real serious dearth and they're on real subsistence levels of calories and nutrition,
yes,
he gives away his rations and he joins the resistance. And I sort of found myself asking myself, could I have made those decisions? And to be honest with you, I'm not sure that I could. They're incredibly generous of spirit. There's an extraordinary selflessness to the man. Mm. And so those two things in combination are sort of the moral decisions and the creative shift over that period were what fascinated me.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Coplin, and my special guest from the arts this week, best-selling British writer Joe Baker. We're going to go to some messages now, but we'll be back with more conversation very soon. And I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years.
Ciao. I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made dessert in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel, and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
Listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, best-selling British author Joe Baker. And if you're local, I just wanted to remind you again that Joe will be appearing at Bookshop Santa Cruz on the 26th of May at 7 p.m. So you'd be able to meet her then, get your book signed, ask her those burning questions that you might have. And you can also connect with Joe on Facebook. If you just put in Joe Baker, and that's Joe, J-O, Baker, writer, then Joe's Facebook page would come up and you can find out what she's up to. Well, before the break, we were talking about Joe's new book, A Country Road, A Tree, where she reimagines the Nobel Prize-winning Irish writer Samuel Beckett's involvement with the French resistance during World War II and what significance that had to his life and his work. What are the advantages of telling Beckett's story as fiction, do you think, Joe, rather than biography?
Well, it's a really interesting kind of dynamic, really, the sort of interplay between the two things. And you can see that it's something that a few novelists have been engaging with lately. There's a Mrs. Hemingway, you know, books like The Paris Wife. So it's something I think that really fascinates people, that engagement with biography. For me, I think what I was able to do was use elements of that were biographically true, but were not necessarily chronologically exactly happening at the moment I have them happen.
Right.
That fit sort of thematically and provide a kind of structure to the novel. For example, James Joyce gave Beckett a coat, and that's a fact. But that happened a little while before my actual story. But because I can play a bit, because I'm working in fiction, I sort of bring that into the war period and the whole sort of falling apart, really, of that relationship with Joyce is traced through, in part, using that coat. So there's a kind of playfulness with that. And I also think because you can't really... I'm sort of slowing down here a bit, because it's a tricky question. But
okay.
For me, one of the things that I felt was interesting about approaching it through fiction was in terms of using the biography, really quite, the biographical information that I had, really quite precisely to think about his reflections on the world. So when I have him sort of think about something, it's those thoughts are sort of captured from sort of factual moments within the biography. Like, for example, I know that he, a particular moment, went to a particular art gallery and looked a particular painting during the war. But that image of that painting is extraordinary, and it's feels very much associated with all the images of the book of being in transit and being on the road, and that again feeds into sort of thinking about Godot and some of the, you know, the trilogy fiction. So there was that kind of sense of like, I can use facts but in a more sort of flexible way, if that makes any sense.
Yes, yeah. As you were describing that, I was just sort of thinking that for all of us as we go through our life, you know, there's all these sort of moments and things that we absorb, and some of it we process consciously, some unconsciously, and what we remember and what we don't remember is very interesting, I think, and iconographic. So in a way, it's like you're bringing all of that together. You're making a tapestry of all of that that is perhaps giving a sense of meaning to his life that, who knows, maybe he didn't even put all those pieces together, but they all existed.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of an interesting process.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of like a collage, really, isn't it? I mean, there are pieces there and you can use them in different ways and fit them in together in different ways. So one is attempting as a kind of a version, an assemblage in a way. And using the structures of fiction to enable that, really.
Yeah. It seems like there must be a daunting amount of research involved to write a book like this. Is that the case?
Well, I mean, as with Longbourn, really, you start by being a fan, so it's not onerous, really,
right,
to, you know, be reading around this period. One thing I love doing is just sort of hunting out images and looking at images and thinking about clothes and thinking about footwear and food and all those things that just sort of make it tangible and sensory as an experience that sort of puts flesh on the bones of the sort of historical period. Yes, there is research, but a lot of it's quite enjoyable, really.
Yes, yeah. Well, I imagine so, or you wouldn't stick with it. I mean,
yes.
I presume, unless you're a masochist.
Yeah.
Beckett's perhaps most famous play, Waiting for Godot, is rather inscrutable to a lot of people. I'm wondering whether you had any desire to elucidate the genesis of Beckett's style for those of us who don't quite get it.
I suppose, you know, as I was saying earlier, that notion of just a little light on moments within his work. Godot, one of the biographers, the first biographer, Deirdre Baird, describes Godot as sort of being generated basically by conversations that he had with his partner, Suzanne, as they were on the run. And I think that's too literal, sort of straightforward linear understanding of creativity, really.
Yes.
But the context of the war is obviously really important. And that sense of the sort of threadbare, but, you know, they're sort of rubbing along together, but it's uncomfortable and, you know, it's the embrace me kind of thing. And then you know, they argue. So I sort of feel that there's sort of parallels be drawn, or little moments to notice, or the occasional sort of image that will elucidate things. I think as with a lot of stuff that comes with a capital L with literature, things often seem more daunting than they really are. You know, if you actually sort of sit down with a text of Godot, It's really light on its feet. It's really funny. It's really sad as well, and really moving. And then, you know, if you read the notes and you hear that they all had that Vladimir and Estragon had much more obviously Jewish names in early drafts, then, you know, that adds a whole other kind of heartbreaking layer to it as well.
Yes. Yeah.
It just sort of squints the reading a little bit. You start to think of it in that context of being on the road, being lost, waiting for a contact that never comes. Not being lost so much as being persecuted, being on the edge of society and waiting for someone that you need but who doesn't come.
Yeah.
As I said, it's not a straightforward explanation, but it's a sort of sense of there is this context we can put around the play as well.
Yeah. I'm wondering what your process for writing is. How do you get from concept to finished book? Is it different for each book, or do you have a sort of schedule? Or I know you've had a family and you've had a, you know, you've had a job, and you've I read somewhere that you were writing from 3 a.m. to 7 a.m. in the morning and then getting on with your day. That sounded very committed.
That was the undertow. We used to call that the Sylvia Plath shift, you know, when the, you wake up and you can't go back to sleep. It was basically using insomnia as productively as I could possibly manage. Thankfully, I don't have to juggle the full-time job as well these days, which is really, really lucky. So I don't have to do the night shift anymore on the writing. For me, it always begins kind of a decade before I start writing, really, at least. There's a little sort of bit of information or an image or something that's got lodged in the back of my brain, and it'll sit there, and it's inert, it'll not be doing anything, it'll just be sitting there. And then something else will sort of drip onto it. And with the Beckett book, it was just that conversation with my tutor about the war and Beckett.
Right.
And then the little drip that landed on it was we took a holiday in France, and we got the train down from Paris to the south of France. And it sounds grander than it was, really, but we got this train, and then sort of halfway down I thought, oh, look, this is, oh, my goodness, there's that. And I realized we were following the route a good deal faster and more comfortably, but we were following the route that Beckett and Suzanne had taken.
Hmm.
And that just made things start to sort of, it's like a catalyst or some kind of chemical reaction, things start to fizz. And then there's the sort of other stories that associate with the other novels where, you know, I've had that similar kind of little bit of information, hangs around for years, and then something comes along and kicks it into life.
Yes.
And then, you know, I go through the very sort of slow process of notes and sometimes diagrams and filling up notebooks longhand, and then move on to typing it up. In the case of Longbourn, I actually typed that onto an iPad because I have RSI, and it actually is a bit of a relief to work on an iPad.
Mm. And are you one of the writers who thinks, you know, you should do a certain number of hours a day, even if you just sit there and stare or whatever? Or do you do believe that?
Well, I tell students, or have told students in the past, that you just basically, if you bang your head against the desk enough, something will happen. I kind of mean it metaphorically. I don't think you should really be banging your head on the desk.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I'm a great believer in just starting to write gibberish until the gibberish starts to refine itself into something. Because you could just break
just
the skin on it. You've got you've got to stop filling up those empty pages.
Yeah,
And that's half the battle, I think, because once you've got something,
then you can
redraft.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you've got a first draft, and it doesn't have to be any good. It just has to be there. You
yes.
know?
Yeah. No, I think that's important. You have to start.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
How important is it to you to have redemptive aspects to the stories you tell, or life affirming themes, or is it important at all?
I think as a reader, I get frustrated by books in which there's no light.
Mm.
You know, those books where you sort of find yourself, that it becomes relentlessly dark.
Yes.
And I suppose, you know, some real, you know, life sometimes for some people is relentlessly dark. But it doesn't feel, you know, I'm a kind of cheerful pessimist, I suppose. I don't sort of feel, you know, that my books are particularly sort of full of, you know, I'm not averse to a happy ending, but I'm not going to force one on readers. It has to feel natural.
Yeah.
And so I think it, for me, I do want to find ways to find some light, you know, because the shade doesn't work either if there's no light, I suppose.
No, absolutely. Some people believe that the arts can be a healing mechanism, even help us process trauma. Do you see a healing aspect to the arts at all? For both the artist and perhaps the consumers of art?
I think that's absolutely true. One of the most satisfying and moving moments that I've ever had professionally is a friend of mine who's a bookseller who told me that a lady had come in to the shop, and she'd spoken to her about Longbourn, and she said her husband had died and she hadn't been able to read anything for ages, and then she picked up Longbourn and she just lost herself in it.
Mm.
And that it had been a huge consolation to just be able to lose herself in that world and you know, enjoy that experience. And I'm so grateful for my friend Gemma for passing that on.
Mm.
But I also feel that it's known that it actually affects the way the brain works. That
mm.
the more you, for example, with reading, people who read fiction tend to be more empathetic towards others.
Mm.
And, you know, we could all use a bit more empathy in the world.
Mm. Absolutely.
And as a writer, for me, it's a very necessary part of staying sort of stable and together and functional, to just kind of, it feels like I'm shuffling the cards and tamping down the pack and making everything neat, and then I can get on with things when I've done my writing.
Yes.
So I do think it's incredibly therapeutic, and I think just that chance to take a step out of like the chatter and the clutter and the busyness of our lives and lose ourselves in a place that is, you know, is laid out for us and we can explore, but we can, you know, we can be in that world away from our own world for a while and inside somebody else's head, you know.
Yeah,
I think that's really helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. We've just got a couple of minutes left, so I just wanted to ask you what's next for you. I'm assuming that the excitement of writing is still alive for you. Have you got plans for your next book yet, or are you just sort of in a rest period?
I'm a little way into it. I'm writing a kind of slightly thrillerish novel. I always just go where the story takes me, so mm. everything can seem a little bit sort of, well, can seem wildly different from the previous novel sometimes. But it's set in a campus. It's a campus novel, and something dreadful has happened, and it's full of these very subjective versions and different stories. So at the moment I'm just kind of plotting it out and working out who's done what and what they say and what lies are being told.
Right. Yeah. Well, I know you're going off on this book tour soon, so
yeah.
I wish you all the very best with that, and we're looking forward to seeing you here in Santa Cruz on the 26th, so I'll be going.
I'm very much looking forward to being there.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and for talking to us. It's been great hearing about your art.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Well, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and thanks again so much to best-selling British writer there, Joe Baker. And just to remind you again, if you want to engage with Joe, you can go to Facebook and put in Joe Baker Writer, J-O Baker Writer, and that'll bring up her Facebook page. You can like that, and then you'll be getting all the latest news on the Longbourn film and the new book, A Country Road, A Tree, and where she's going to be. So I encourage you to do that. And as I mentioned before, if you are local to Santa Cruz, she's going to be here on the 26th of May at 7 p.m. So I'm going to be going, so I hope to see you there. And just to remind you also that you can go to the show's website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. If you enjoy this interview, you can tell your friends about it. They'll be able to hear the podcast, and also there'll be photos and more information about Joe there. And you can also check out all the other podcasts, the wonderful guests and interesting topics that we've had. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to you joining me next time.